Hello, this is your Polycast for Friday, September 16th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, some legislative candidates have been tripped up by their past, and Minneapolis police will track race and gender on traffic stops. Embarrassing disclosures about a few first-time candidates for the state legislature are providing openings for their opponents. Whether the problem sinks those candidates remains to be seen, but they serve as a reminder that people's lives and their social media comments are accessible, and that even low-visibility legislative campaigns are fodder for background researchers. Brian Baxt has more.
Brad Sanford is a Republican running for an open Senate seat in the northern suburbs. It's a race Republicans are high on in their quest to win the Senate majority. Sanford is stressing the need for spending discipline in state government. But as the campaign reaches its apex, Sanford has other finances to worry about. His own. A judge ruled this month that Sanford owes more than $44,000 in back child support stemming from a 2009 divorce. The judgment is a culmination of a court battle in progress since the winter.
Do I believe that I don't owe this? Absolutely not. I contested it because I didn't agree with the dollar amount. But at the end of the day, I've always made my payments, and I will continue to make these payments.
Sanford is an insurance salesman and sometimes Uber driver who says the situation should not distract from a discussion of more important matters in the campaign.
I think it's a non-issue. I take care of my kids, and I have always made my payments. The issue is done and over.
Sanford isn't the only candidate dealing with a problem from the past at an inopportune time. This week, the Star Tribune exposed troubling Facebook posts about women, the Confederate flag, President Obama, and gays by Blaine Area House candidate Nolan West. He has since apologized and removed the posts, but they could complicate Republican efforts to win that hotly contested open seat. Republican House Speaker Kurt Dowd publicly expressed disappointment with West. In July, the Star Tribune also drew attention to a 1980s divorce ruling that involved DFL candidate Jerry Loud in a key northwestern Minnesota House race. The ruling included a finding that Loud battered his then-wife. Loud said he had learned from his mistakes in the past, but Democratic Party leaders distanced themselves from his campaign. DFL Party Chairman Ken Martin says all of the incidents highlight gaps in vetting of legislative candidates.
There's no doubt that each party got caught with that this year, not doing enough self-research, is what we call it, enough self-research on our own candidates.
Republican Party Chairman Keith Downey agrees that times have changed, given how easy it is to peek into candidate pasts.
Now, literally anybody who's fairly effective with the web browser can do quite a bit.
The parties spend loads of time and money delving into candidates on the other side. Less common is research into their own legislative hopefuls. Sometimes it comes down to an honor system, where candidates bring up their own potential red flags. Republican Michael Broadcorp is a former party operative known for strategically using deep dive research against opponents. He says this year's incidents demonstrate how expanding digital footprints are easily mined and flaws can't be ignored.
You're running for office, everything's an open book. And it will ultimately be up to the public to decide what is or isn't fair game.
Broadcorp describes a tension between candidate desire for privacy and the chance problems will bubble up anyway. Jake Wagman runs Shield Political Research. It's a vetting firm based in Indiana that has Democratic legislative clients in the Midwest, but none so far in Minnesota. Services like his are becoming increasingly common for candidates lower on the ballot.
When I do self-research on a candidate, I tell my client, don't tell me anything. I don't want to know anything about you. I want to start from scratch so I can replicate what the opposition will do.
Here's his basic routine. Contact area police agencies for reports. Look at court and tax records for sign of legal or financial problems. Make sure resumes hold up. And scour social media sites for posts a candidate might regret.
My worst nightmare is to have something hit against my client that we didn't know about. That scares the bejesus out of me because that's what we exist to counter.
The self-vetting doesn't come cheap, and it competes with other vital components in a campaign budget. But as Wagman says, getting caught cold with an ill-timed disclosure can be devastating and turn a once-promising candidate into an unelectable one. Covering politics, I'm Brian Baxt, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A study out this week suggests that microplastics in the Great Lakes may be more widespread than previously thought. Some microplastics are known to be harmful to fish and wildlife, and this new study is likely to prompt more research into their impact. Dan Crocker reports.
There's been a lot of research recently into these tiny particles called microbeads. They're really small, less than 5 millimeters in diameter. They can affect reproduction and growth of fish and shellfish that ingest them. And researchers have discovered them in surprisingly high numbers in the Great Lakes. Those findings spurred Congress to pass a law last year banning the sale of shampoos and other personal care products that contain plastic microbeads. But studies so far have focused on the Great Lakes. A new study published in the journal Environmental Science and Technology looked at rivers that flow into the Great Lakes. And what the researchers didn't find surprised them.
We expected to see more microbeads, like was found in the Great Lakes.
Austin Baldwin is the study's lead author. He's a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Instead of microbeads, he says the research team mostly found tiny plastic fibers that are shed from synthetic clothes like fleece.
There have been a couple studies on how many of these particles come off of a fleece when you wash it, and it's in the numbers of a few thousand to even several hundred thousand little plastic fibers come off of a single fleece when you wash it. Kind of staggering.
Scientists found microplastics in all 29 rivers they sampled, including the St. Louis River, which flows into Lake Superior at Duluth. The highest levels were found in rivers in urban watersheds, like the Huron River at Ann Arbor, Michigan, and the Buffalo River in upstate New York. But rivers with heavily forested shorelines, like the St. Louis, also had plastics. Baldwin says that raises questions about where these fibers are coming from.
There's evidence that these fibers are coming from the atmosphere, tiny little pieces of plastic fibers floating around in the air.
And then settling on roads and other surfaces before eventually washing into rivers. Baldwin says he's now looking at what happens to these plastic fibers when rivers dump them into the Great Lakes. His hypothesis is that they end up in the sediment at the bottom of the lakes because, unlike microbeads, which float, microfibers sink. And while studies have shown the effect of microplastics on aquatic life, Baldwin says the big question is whether they're harmful to humans.
So we're eating them, we're breathing them in, we're drinking them. The question then, of course, is that a problem?
That's still a question researchers are a long way from answering. Covering the environment, I'm Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
Minneapolis police say they've started keeping track of the race and gender of people they pull over for traffic stops and in other interactions. As Matt Sepik reports, Chief Janae Harto says it's an effort to increase transparency and that the department will make the data public on a regular basis.
Civil rights groups and the city's Police Conduct Oversight Commission have long been pushing for better data collection by Minneapolis police officers, especially in cases where a person is stopped for being suspicious but not booked. Police call those investigatory stops. And a commission study last year found that officers documented the race of the people they stopped just 11% of the time. Commission member and Minneapolis attorney Jennifer Singleton says the data collection effort will help the public learn a lot more about suspicious person and traffic stops. Singleton says there's widespread concern about racial profiling, but only anecdotal information to back it up.
When that data isn't collected, we just don't really have a way of knowing what exactly is going on and who's being stopped and why they're being stopped. So it's hard to get a handle on just what's happening.
In a statement, Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harto says officers must now keep track of race and gender when conducting suspicious vehicle and person stops, as well as traffic stops. The chief says squad car computers are set up so that officers must enter that data, plus the reason for the interaction, before they can close out the call. St. Paul police have been tracking racial data on certain types of calls for about 15 years. Minneapolis NAACP President Nikema Levy-Pounds says the MPD's move is a step in the right direction toward accountability, but she says data collection is only the first step.
The question will be how the Minneapolis Police Department decides to use the data that it collects in changing the behavior of officers, especially when there are concerns surrounding racial profiling and mistreatment of people of color.
Levy Pound says the MPD needs to take a close look at the use of low-level ordinances as a reason to stop people, and she says the department should appoint someone to analyze the data and ensure that it's used to change police procedures. Chief Harto says the new policy came after conversations with groups including the ACLU, the Police Conduct Oversight Commission, and the Officers Union. Minneapolis Police Federation President Lieutenant Bob Kroll says the union doesn't have a problem with data collection, but Kroll says to get an accurate picture of any alleged bias by officers, researchers must compare racial data from suspicious person stops with the physical descriptions of suspects reported by 911 callers.
The data needs to start there. And if they do that, we are fine with the rollout and the collection of on the back end. But otherwise, any type of study, the figures can and probably will look skewed.
Chief Harto says the demographic data of suspects as reported by 911 callers is being recorded. Officers must also track race and gender data on truancy calls, curfew violations, and attempted pickups of people wanted for criminal activity. Police also have to document whether they conducted a search. Harto says the MPD will analyze and publicly release the investigatory stop data every quarter. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
And that's your Polycast for this Friday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. Have a great weekend, and I'll see you again here next week.